how do you keep love in your heart when you are a killer? And honestly, the first thing I would say is that I can't wait to start again. What do I do when my players hate Merlin? This is like a gamer's white whale. The generosity of GMs and advice and knowledge and people of this community has been just frankly unparalleled for me.
Hi friends, and welcome to Mind Your Manners. This week I sit down with Eric Vulgaris to discuss his experience running King Arthur Pendragon in the Great Pendragon Campaign. With the impending launch of 6th edition, this felt like the right moment to explore this game. For those of you who may not be familiar with it, Pendragon is a game of medieval knights in the Age of Arthur. It was designed by Greg Stafford with mechanics that tied into the thematic seamlessly. Knights are big personas driven by opposing personality traits and all-consuming passions. To steal a line from the 6th edition starter set, this is a time of desperate battles, dark portents, enchanted forests, pride, and self-indulgence. The Great Pendragon Campaign, or GPC, is an 81-year campaign spanning multiple eras. Your knights will seek glory, accomplish great or foul deeds, conduct intrigues, and quest for treasures. Also, a healthy dose of great battles in there. Links to these products and Eric's streamed games can be found in the description. Enjoy. Eric, welcome. Thanks for joining me. I am Kerry Dolan, pronouns he, him. I would love to hear about your introduction to RPGs in general before we get into King Arthur Pendragon.
Sure. Well, hi, Kerry, and hi, everyone watching. Happy time zones to you all. Yeah, I'm Eric, pronouns he, him. And so my very beginning of role-playing games came back from, when I was 12, 13 or so. A buddy of mine brought a copy of the Player's Handbook, had to be the second edition Player's Handbook, to a week-long Boy Scout retreat. And I was like, what the hell are you reading during the days? And all of a sudden it just kind of opened up and I was like, oh, well, tell me more. So how does this work? What's it? And by the time we were, at the end of that retreat, I was like, hey, I'm coming over. We're playing this. Like, I want to do this really badly. And that was sort of my first real like kind of look into role-playing games. And, then as you do when you get into high school and college, I kind of fell out and tried to be, cool and drink and be very popular and social. And I was like, what am I doing? And then I finally went back to my roots, started running Pathfinder again and all that kind of stuff. Cause that was the time, if you recall the edition wars of the day, and never been happier.
So you actually started with second edition. That is a tough edition to read through. Like looking back at it, I'm playing in a second edition, fifth edition hybrid game that they're wrapping up after 3 years tonight. It's a big day. But coming into second edition as a player for the first time is daunting.
Oh, absolutely. I knew. I was like, listen, he showed me like what it would take to be, a spellcaster. And I was like, nah, no, thanks. I can barely wrap my head around strength. Why is there a fraction in my strength? What is this thing out of zeros? That's fine. I'll just do that. So, it's literally just made a basic fighter starting out.
But we are here to talk about King Arthur Pendragon. So you have been running the 5.2 edition with some modifications. Right. Tell me a little bit about your history with that game.
Yeah, so I was very lucky that my very first experience with Pendragon wasn't me running it. It was me being a player in someone else, my friend Steven, in their game, and they streamed it. So lo and behold, I was like, okay, I guess I'm going into this. This will be fine. This was, I think, when did Hamilton come out? Was that around that year? And it had to be around 2016, I think, because I was in Seattle at the time. And so I really didn't know what to expect at all. I knew it wasn't going to be Dungeons and Dragons, right? I knew we weren't just be fighting all the time. And I only kind of knew it through, a scientist would study a black hole. Like, I knew it through observation of like its impact around the hobby, talking to people with this reputation of like, oh, wow, this is like a gamer's white whale thing that everybody would like, at this point, some of the players, these are old heads who have been gaming for 30 plus years and stuff like that. Some of them are designers being like, yeah, this is like their white whale. It's their favorite game. They describe so much how inspirational it's been to their designs. And that, through this massive reputation, I was like, yeah, I'm totally in. I know a little bit about, your standard chivalry, stuff like that. But I had no idea what I was signing up for at the time. Right. And yeah, so this game, I remember my character's name was Sir Nidian. And one of the funny things about this game was that, I tried so hard to like be a knight in my head about like what you think of in the Age of Chivalry, but in the Age of Uther, and I kind of had this like weird kind of like, oh, this isn't doesn't feel right. Like I'm something's not hitting right. And so I kind of had this mixed success at the start because I was like I was trying to do something that the game wasn't trying to do at the time. And once I picked up on that though, it was smooth sailing, and that game was super memorable. And for quite a few cons, you know, like Gen Con and the like, we would bump into each other in real life and we'd call each other by our characters' names and stuff like that. It was a very big, impactful game to us. So I was very happy about it. And yeah, it always just stuck around for me.
How much of that did you actually play through? Did you make it through like the entire GPC or?
No. We made it to right before the Anarchy. So,
okay.
Yeah. So we were wrapping up around that point. And that was, yeah, once things starting to pop off. But like that was the first time I was like, oh, yeah, there's this manorial phase. How am I getting this money? How can I focus and get my sword up? Oh my God, I'm doing 46 damage and I can't do anything. How am I supposed to distinguish myself as a knight? Yeah, you know, and there's all these like kind of funny mistakes. And, you know, the one of the more experienced characters and players in that, or one of the most experienced players in that game was like, oh yeah, I'm going to be, is it okay if I'll be a Saxon? I'm going to have an axe. I'm going to do, you know, 5d6 damage. And like, you know, I was like, oh, this is why he went full strength. Like, I get it. I understand now why you would do that. As opposed to some of the more courtly things.
And so that stuck with you clearly. When did you feel like you were going to start tackling that as, you know, a game runner?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So it never, once you have the first taste of that game, it never really leaves you. So you're always thinking about, oh, man, okay, what can I do differently? Like, oh, would I run it? Would I actually do that? And, you know, a couple of years went by and I was like, I need this to run. I don't want to run, you know, 5e anymore. I want to pick something different at this time. I want to do something. I just want to stick with it. And after talking to a couple of friends at a convention, it was one of those things where I was like, listen, it's going to be really hard to do this kind of commitment for the GPC, right? You know, it's going to be multiple years. I think I told them it was going to be 2 years playing weekly at 2-hour sessions. And here we are, like year four. But like, you know, so it goes. But yeah, I was like, let's dedicate this. I've been thinking about it. I have nonstop. I really want to get started on it. And, you know, you two are like this, like I'm telling you, this is going to be a hard commitment. And they're like, oh, well, you know, we've already heard about it. Similar to me through that sort of like black hole observational effect of like, this is the thing to want to do. And that's what we did. So the two of us started running it and love it.
What do you think made it stick with you so intensely? Was it like, do you think it was the players, yeah, the game master, the mechanics, the thematics?
It's definitely the thematics and the mechanics and the way they get married to this game. We looked at the game originally from a like, oh, this is really interesting how you can kind of lose control of your character through passions and things like that. But really, the game really started to pick up when we realized more of the stuff outside of combat and more about how just traits in general work. And how you can divest yourself of success or failure from the traits, but rather than like, what does it actually kind of feel like that you're doing? And once you kind of start realizing the question is almost more like how something happens and how you want to do something and whether you do it for quote unquote the right or wrong reasons, or and starting to see more about how these people feel more alive. And I think the addiction of playing this game comes from like, oh, yeah. Like, because we're not perfect agents in real life, right? We're emotional, you know, like we can, I would hate to see me and cut me off in traffic if, you know, I didn't eat lunch, you know, and I'm mad or, you know, like there's a million reasons, you know, like there's a ton of the different reasons that we're always out of control of ourselves or, in, you know, perfect harmony with our emotions and things like that. So having the ability to have a game where it's expressive, where you can be like, I guess, oh, wow, I guess I don't, you know, I don't stand up for her, you know, in this court case, I back away. And then you use that to springboard the next thing where you're like, oh, I'm never letting that happen again. You know, I'm going to dig down and, you know, or something like that. Right. And it's very, an incredible addictive experience.
Yeah. It's very melodramatic. Like new players really need to come into it with that understanding that like, no, lean into this as heavily as possible. Like soap opera wise, right? Like it is a different style of play. And, you know, let's assume for a second that the listeners of this podcast only have fifth edition history, or any sort of D&D. How do you describe the traits and passions mechanic to a first time player? Like, because that's a key difference. Yeah. Like at the end of the day, we're knights with swords and we're talking to people and all that sort of thing. but this is a key differentiator.
Yeah. So I'm actually going to steal this line from one of my players, my player Jim. He described it as, you know, normally when we, I was alluding to this earlier, when we play most role-playing games, we're almost like in a mech of our character with perfect one-to-one actuation of what we do. Jim described it as playing a Pendragonite is kind of like steering a super tanker, where like you have to plan to, you know, you decide on something and then you kind of see where it goes. It's much harder to steer. And being prepared to not to play to find out how your character does something or what they do is just as important as you know, any other kind of goals of a power fantasy. And I think once you relinquish that, it helps. And I certainly think it helps that both my character players are GMs themselves. So they're used to sort of having that kind of distance, let's see what happens kind of approach. But that's definitely the big one, is being able to let things be, like, it's okay to not be in full control. And that's definitely it's an alien experience compared to other role-playing games, for sure.
You know, tell me a little bit about this 3 or 4 year streaming game that you've got going on. We'll link your YouTube channel in the description here. But
thank you.
It's an impressive achievement just to, on a scheduling front to begin with, but.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I know. And we're so dedicated, you know, we have about 15 years left of the game and we're like, oh my God, it's amazing to see how far we've come. And honestly, the first thing I would say is that I can't wait to start again. And when that happens, I'm running it again, straight from the top. You know, I cannot wait. It is so, so amazing. Let me kick it back real quick before I describe the game. And I want to talk about some of the other designs and, you know, critiques I had from me being a player. Because when I came into this game, I think every GM wants to run the game that they wish they could be as a player in. Right. It's kind of like, this is the vision, right? This is the thing that they always wish they had. The irony is to have what you want.
The curse of the forever GM. That's why they do it.
Correct. Yeah, it's exactly, to have what you want means you have to be the one providing it, right? So that's the curse. But so a few of the things I definitely wanted to add to this game was, I definitely wanted more time for feasts and social stuff and family, because I felt like even in like my 3 hour sessions with 4 players, you know, we barely got to touch on anything other than the summer event. And then the winter phase was the spreadsheets at the end. And I really wanted more it kind of felt like I never had a chance to express who a character is or a person is over time, right? With the relationships. And so that was super keen to me to emphasize, right? Relationships of family, just your personal stuff, your relationships to like your role, not just as a knight and head of manor, but like to your liege and all the performative duties and perfunctory duties of being a knight in a castle, you know, like during Easter and all that kind of stuff, right? So I definitely wanted to do that. And then lastly, like through the great following the great Pendragon's timeline, I always felt like some things kind of just came at you out of nowhere. And you're like, why didn't we hear about that earlier? Right. So that was the other thing I definitely wanted to do. And, you know, no, I'm sorry. I love the GM that ran it for me. So hopefully it doesn't sound like I'm harshing their vibe. They're incredible. I would play with them 100% anytime. Right. But the thing I wanted to point out was like, oh yeah, I definitely want you to foreshadow these events more. I want things to kind of, you know, you can see the clouds coming in when appropriate, right? And that I felt would be really strong. So those are like the big design things I wanted to add to the game, right? So when I started running it, I almost divested a lot of the time of how to run this thing into random tables. I found as many different resources as I could on the forums and the Discords. The generosity of GMs and advice and knowledge and people of this community has been just frankly unparalleled for me. The sharing of this game and sharing anything that I made for people to get started as well. Yeah, so I found like the Book of Solos and like some of the solo kind of events for people who've been trying to run Pendragon for themselves. And I was like, oh, well, what if I threw an event in that in this year? And, you know, everything sort of clicked in mind when I was running this game, when I realized, okay, I need to structure my prep as a timeline for the year, right? Now, I'm sure you know how this goes when you're prepping, right? And so, yeah, I always just come back to like, how do I refine my prep to make this game feel as sandboxy as I could, right? So that involved a lot of rolling events ahead of time, right? I would roll, for example, I will get to it later, but like, you know, manorial luck events and things like that, or like the family events in winter, and then foreshadow them during the year. So, you know, if somebody, for example, is going to die this year, because like, you know, whatever, I rolled their survival check and they failed, you know, then I'll roll maybe what season it is. So it's not like just everyone's keeling over in the winter, right? You can be like, oh man, like my, you know, like, oh, my grandfather's sick, or, you know, or like my horse is ill, you know, like in the summer. And so then you're balancing like that fact, you know, or like, you know, the person you like, or your kid's sick, and it's like, oh crap, my kid's sick, and I'm getting marshaled off to go on a cattle raid, you know, so that's in my head. And so I'm gonna love a family because I'm gonna do this, I can pay for the medicine to save my kid, you know, like all of a sudden, like, you can make these kind of links together, and everything starts to flow and connect, rather than just being out of nowhere like, okay, well, I definitely need the money from the cattle raid to make sure that I'm not poor this year. I guess my kid died. You know, I was like, that's one way to do it for sure, but I feel like there's a little bit more fun, and when there's like kind of the sinew that's happening where not everything's backloaded or front loaded.
Two questions for you, because one, it seems like you've created yourself a lot of work at the start before a game even gets going, right?
Yeah.
Before the players are even engaged and understand the rules. I mean, how many weeks or months in advance did you feel like you had to start getting that together? I mean, did you even feel like you hit a point where, you know, by the date that you were going to start running this, that you were actually feeling prepared for
that? No, there's no sense of feeling prepared for this game. And I think that's an important lesson for GMing anything, really, is that you're never going to be fully prepared. You just have to roll with the punches and continually to iterate, right? The best you can do is show up with what you got and go on from there. So, you know, the first session, thankfully, is a session zero, right? So there's a lot of stuff where you're not really doing that much as a GM. You don't have to prepare necessarily the first year. Maybe like just the knighting ceremony of the knights. It's mostly for the players that day to figure out who their characters are. And then from there, you start to, you know, you take the week or whatever your time is between sessions to then flesh out like, okay, here's their family members. How do they integrate to the rest of the world? But like, I think if starting out, the most important things you should figure out are, where are your player knights from? Like, where are their manors, if they have manors, right? Second is, where's their family? Where are they located from? And then start to develop the relationships around like, okay, well, who are your neighbors? Who maybe a couple of those knights and those names you should know, and maybe a little bit about dispositions of them, and go from there, right? So you should know those people, like just basically your local orbit of neighborly relations and things like that, which also means you should probably know like the castellans and your earl as well, right? Because those are also the big people that you're going to be dealing with in your life at all time that you should. You know, basically your managers, like if you think of it as almost like a weird corporate kind of environment, you're like, oh yeah, okay, well, like, yeah, this is, you know, when DeVry or DeVries, Castellan comes over, you're like, oh yeah, well, this is like the general manager from the, you know, two stores over, right? And so you're like, okay, well, you have to show them deferential respect and things like that, and like they're important because they know your manager in a different way, you know, like there's like this sort of like politicking of in a business analogy here, where you can leverage some of that stuff that if you don't prep that ahead of time, you can lose. And I really think that kind of stuff really is like a seasoning for a good game of Pendragon.
Yeah, it feels like you want to prep the NPCs and the situations more so than like in D&D when you're prepping like a dungeon or something like that. I mean, and there's also a unique structure to the way that the Great Pendragon campaign it runs. You know, we've got seasons.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, maybe we should take a step back and just outline how the Great Pendragon campaign is laid out. We have multiple eras. We have a year-to-year structure where 1 year is almost one session, depending on how big the battles get.
For sure. There's quite a few of them, yeah.
So it's a very different structure. And I think it's a really fun system to run. It's been used for other games as well. We've seen that with like the Darkening of Mirkwood campaign for the One Ring. When you think about running this again, what would you go back and change? How would you approach the opening differently? And I guess we should preface this by saying that the original or the most recent version of the Great Pendragon campaign starts in the Age of Uther. The new edition, sixth edition, is going to start with the pulling of the sword from the stone.
Right. I think that's such a good call. It's figuring out now what I know now. I think the eras really matter, and understanding what's going on in each era and how different they are from each other is so important. And the reason for starting in the Boy King and why I love that so much is because that actually solves so much of the whiplash that I have of expectations versus reality of the game. Because I was expecting, you know, because in the Age of Uther, things are nasty and brutal, right? It's not as bad as the Anarchy, right? But like, it's supposed to be this terror, like it's not a good time, You are a warlord. The existential threat of the Saxons is very real, right? Uther is just making, just basically strong arming everybody and being like, this is our last best hope if we're going to survive. The Kimmer culture is going to survive, right? So like, there's a sort of desperation, this harsh reality. There's even like, just you're still stealing from your neighbors even at that time just to make ends meet, right? And like, that is not like, oh, there, sir, shall we tilt at the bridge? Kind of, kind of stuff, right? It's a completely different vibe. And so starting from the Boy King, you don't have that problem. You don't get to see, one of my players, Colin, mentioned that, the importance and prevalence of the round table, right? The table is round, but you have to show that a table is square is before you accept why the round table is round is important, right? The ideas of where the hierarchies of the salt, where you're sitting, how stewards can only sit on one side and knights sit on the other. Like, so the idea of like presenting that sort of thing, and then it's kind of seeing that, it's like, great, but really at the start, let's just see what the round table is first and just get that kind of experience first. And then once you have that under your belt, yeah, sure, you can go back and play the prequels, right? Like, it's almost like asking somebody to watch Star Wars and being like, you have to start with episode one and watch them sequentially, right? Like, you don't have to do that at all. Like, you know what I mean? Like the Age of Uther and stuff like that is like the Phantom Menace. You're like, you don't need to start there at all. You can clearly start with A New Hope. You can start wherever you want, right? So like, yeah, I like that decision to do that. But so like just understanding sort of like what the Boy King's about and being like, well, why would people not necessarily go along with Arthur at the start, right? And maybe like, so starting off thinking about that a little bit and playing up like this slow political conflict war of like why people don't believe them, and then how do they get won over? It's not always through a sword, right? And like it's all this amazing stuff right now, which is also great starting at the Boy King, because I think the most, I don't know if this is true, maybe it's true for you, but I think the number one piece of advice from GMs of Pendragon who've been playing it for a little bit are like, what do I do when my players hate Merlin? Like, they start, between the framing of him, right, on the sword and the escape of the Arthur and that kind of, like, it's like, those are the starts where, I think that's usually the start where players are like, I'm not really sure I like Merlin. And then obviously as a GM, you're like, you're panicking because you're like, oh my God, my players hate Merlin. Like, what are we going to do? Like, that would be like, you hate King Arthur, right? But instead it's like, no, well, in the Boy King, just play them on the other side. They will fight with King Lot, right? And if they are, or King Mark or Grolar, whatever is the remnants in Cornwall, Like basically anybody who's not sure about the king, right? The Boy King, like, that's fine. And then play them being converted, right? That's an opportunity. Right. Like, I don't think you should address things necessarily as problems in the Great Pendragon campaign that maybe feel as problems. Instead, they're just great opportunities just to present the story just from a different side.
And I think that's an important point, too. Right. Like, the Great Pendragon campaign is all of these things that are set in motion. Like, You don't need to run a faction phase like Stars Without Number, Worlds Without Number, because it's already rolled for you. That's the gist of this. I sometimes hear from players like, oh, well, I don't get to be King Arthur. I'm not, steering the ship here. And it's like, well, not exactly, but you're a witness to massive events in history, quote unquote, and you are influencing things.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the easiest ways to influence it would be what side of a war you're on. And it's like, do you really not believe he's, I honestly, this guy's art. He's a boy. He's 13. He pulled a sword. Okay, big deal, right? Meanwhile, he's aligned with Merlin. Merlin is clearly like a pagan, like not necessarily the smartest guy. He led Uther to his death. We've been through the anarchy. Maybe listening to that guy is not as, and telling us that the sword is the makes someone king is maybe not the best way of judging things, right? Then all of a sudden you fight and then you realize that actually he's a pretty good guy. And actually like the reasons for studying him or following him is maybe perhaps not just through might, like through Uther, right? And just making sure through force and by conquering he is them, but like actually through just. And I think the story and tragedy of Arthur is actually almost better portrayed if the players don't go along on the side of the king at starting off, right? They aren't just like his ride or die immediately. It's almost better to be like, because you do get to see that. You almost get to see this portrayal and this tragedy of like, no, I won't just be a conqueror. I will usher, I will midwife a better society, right? And how that does not outlive him, but like it's awesome to see, right? And have this sort of hope. So I think that's very, very cool.
Yeah. And what you want are those character moments, those moments of revelation and growth
exactly.
and evolution.
Right? Like, imagine you being with your skill on the battlements or in the battlefield, and you charge against the, you know, your knights of, you know, basically like Silchester or whatever, who's allied with him at this point, right? And your guys are cut down or whatever. And like, you just see him leading. Meanwhile, King Lot's like in the back, being like, you could do this, as he's like getting on his rouncy and getting away, right? And you're like, oh, what the fuck? What the heck, man? Like, you know, I'm being struck out. And like, you see him leading from the front with a shining sword, and you're like, this guy's got it, maybe. You know what I mean? Or like, and you can
he's
have
got,
that.
He's got that riz.
Like, yeah, yeah, you can almost play that converted. You can play the converted, and like then the idea of you actually being a true diehard to Arthur, because you're like, dude, I watched him cut down, you know, like all these other knights, and I was the last one, and he gave me mercy, right? I'm with him. Like, those are some really powerful moments. And like, yeah, sure, we know that Arthur is going to be king, but like, we don't know how that that's my story. Or maybe I die and I play my next character, and I'm like, Arthur killed my dad, you know, like blah, blah, blah. And like, you get to play that sort of like thing, right? There's so many different ways of doing it. I think that'd be so interesting. Yeah. And it's exactly what you said. Just like letting like everything's on this sort of track, right? The faction turn has already been done, but there's so much spaces for development and how you fit into that, right? So playing to find out how something happens, in my point, in my mind, it's just as fun as playing to find out what happened.
I think Greg Stafford laid it out when he put this central question in the book, which is, what kind of knight are you? Like, that's what you're playing to find out. And
exactly.
Everything in the game feeds into answering that question, from the mechanics to the scenarios to this, you know, the way that you interact with other players.
Yeah. Can I add on that real quick?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, what kind of knight are you? This is something that also I espouse from the game so much, is that I think it's Lancelot who says that a knight must have two hearts, a heart of wax and a heart of steel. Right. And a heart, you know, that is soft and malleable, to be delicate to, you know, at court and kind. And then also one that can just dispassionately, you know, smite Saxons on the battlefield. Right. And then come back. Now, obviously, it's a false dichotomy. Obviously, you can be like a loving father and also a warrior and stuff like that. But I think Pendragon really wants you to kind of choose, like, how do you keep love in your heart when you are a killer? Right. And I think that's sort of that what kind of knight are you, and having to kind of pick between those two is actually like really, really juicy stuff. And that's something I always loved about this game, and something I would like to push more in my next one.
You know, we're kind of circling around this topic of like a medieval mindset at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that players need to get a feel for as they start playing, which is, you know, you are playing the game for glory. Honor is a factor. You know, the idea that might makes right, and that's why you might lay down your arms and serve Arthur in that scenario that we just talked about. How do you get, when you're talking to someone that is not a big history buff, you know, you got very lucky having two players that are huge history buffs and really lean into it, but if you were bringing in someone that was just like, you know, in your 5e group or whatever, how do you think you would approach that?
Well, I'm pretty sure the sixth edition will probably do a good job about explaining sort of the perfunctory stuff. Like, hey, this is a manor. This is what you're owed. You know, you give 40 days of service. In return, you get to have this land, right? And this kind of thing, right? But I really think the du jour responsibilities of a knight are not as interesting as the de facto stuff. So, and getting to play the idea of like, okay, so what really does it mean to be a knight with 40 days of service? And like, you know, does that mean, do I really have to show up every time? What will happen if I don't? You know, there's a million different ways of doing this. So when you're explaining to a new player, I think I would probably start with a sort of a brief, you know, maybe 5 bullet points most of like, you know, you do this, you're required to do this. This is why you have your land, right? This is your role of that. Your manor is your lifeline. If you can't provide for yourself, then you can't provide your duty. And all of a sudden things look really bad, right? Lastly, like the most important part is actually like, feudalism is basically it's not like necessarily an MLM, but it's definitely like this abusive structure where the person above you needs to like basically take more than their fair share in order to justify their place in society. So like it's this really complicated thing, but like, I guess the simplest, I don't know, I wish I had more time to think about a little bit of like the bullet points here, but like, the gist is that if I'm an earl, if I let the people below me, and I'm fair to them and reward them based on their merit, then they might wonder why do they need an earl, right? And then all of a sudden you have this problem on your hand because you were too nice, right? But on the other side, if you take too much for yourself, and you're dealing with the problem of like, I hate, you know, my Earl's a tyrant. He takes too much from me. It's not fair. Why do I need an Earl? Right. So like, there's this delicate balance. And I think having that sort of like delicate balance be portrayed of like, listen, like it is this kind of this weird needy situation. Like they need you to need them. That's why, like when you go on a raid or you give this money, that's why the gifting of the feast is so important. I really think like highlighting like this feast is so important because it really shows, the lens and like it is the economic and social way of like confluence of this point entirely is that through Feaster and through these feasts and things stuff like that, you show that like anything that you make, it goes to the Earl and then the Earl dispenses it. And like that is, and how the Earl dispenses things is the politics of the world. And I think doing that is and like explaining that almost through play is almost better than the bullet points, but like just understanding that sort of crux of the hierarchy and the social chain and how that works is so important.
Let's pause there for a second.
Sure.
Let's dig into that year-long structure a little bit and the way that you've presented it, because you have a pretty clear formula. You run things like justice events. You run Feaster, which we are recording immediately before. I want to talk about the feast system in particular. It is a separate book. I know it is being brought into sixth edition as something more central, which is fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
Let's start there, because you start every year with either a justice event leading into Feaster or you start with Feaster directly. Let's for the good people out there, let's explain what's going on here.
Sure. Okay. So the way I structure my prep and notes is entirely on this sort of year basis, right? So I break it out into the four seasons, right? Feaster comes at the end of spring. So what I'll do here is I have a list of about 13 or so different types of, like I call them scenes, but like that's just the story game part of my brain, but they can be kind of anything. I don't know if you want the whole list right now or anything like that, but like in general, you know, think of stuff like a lesson involving your squire or like a relationship with your land or a relationship with, you know, your kin or something like that. Right. Or a relationship with your faith. And like, if I roll and I get one in spring, then like, cool, then maybe before spring we'll do that. And if I don't roll for something like that and there's some time, maybe I'll just leave space. And my notes was just like space to ask the player if they want to do anything this spring. Right. Or follow up from something from winter, right. Something obvious. It's usually pretty, pretty clear. Right. So then we go into Feaster, and Feaster is where you start to foreshadow the events for the summer or even like the future summers. Right. So like I write my notes there for that. And then when we get to the actual playing of the feast, we do the whole mini game. We roll to see what food we're eating. We roll for our appearance and everything like that. Right. So like that. And we play the scenes. Almost everybody hopes to get their cards because we just find the cards so interesting. And what they tell us about the characters. And I think it's really important in when you're running the game to involve Feast, because it involves so many different other types of roles that you wouldn't really expect.
I mean, just to set the scene for folks that don't know, feasts are kind of like a mini game. It uses a lot of social interaction between you and between the player knights and the NPCs. It is a place where your character can easily go off the rails. You overindulge a bit, and it's card driven, and those cards have different events. So it is kind of like a random table in card form.
Totally.
When you think back on, you know, the 40 plus that you've probably run at this point, 80 plus, I don't know how many we're at this point. I mean, 88 years and the whole thing, I think. Can you think of like a super memorable moment that came out of that completely changed a character?
Oh, yeah. Totally. So one of the major ones I definitely recall is it's a funny moment is that one of Jim's characters, Gorthrin, just becomes king of the bean. And like the idea of just like out of nowhere, like at the end of the feast, he just shows like you're one of the characters just shows up like after like a tense situation and stuff like that. They leave for a little bit and they just show up and they like are basically like the jester or like the joke for the prize and kind of like the funny guy that everyone kind of watches and looks. It's like it was just one of those incredible moments that like you just couldn't think of better at the time. But like there's been plenty of like super intense conversations at feasts about like politics, relationships, creating, you know, political marriages and the things like that over dinner. I think that kind of stuff has just like been so crucial. And if anything, going into like the next campaign or like something I want to do more is I've been really something I noticed later in the eras is that when people roll intrigue and people are doing more stuff in feasts about like wanting to learn about politics and the secrets and stuff like that, you're like, man, you should be really checking suspicious. Because like that's what you're doing. You're not trusting people. And so the people who know the most going on also have the lowest trust of people, because you always can find secrets on people. And like, and remember, like, not forgetting what the sort of means, whatever you do during a feast, and just letting, you know, and letting people describe how they do stuff, right? So for example, if they are, you know, if you're having a, even from a card, right? And then the card might be something like boasting about your own deeds, right, to a bunch of other knights around. And some of the major context from that would is one of my favorites actually from this time. So this kind of perfectly dovetails into your original question, right? So like Gorthrun, or you know, somebody would draw a card and it would be like, explain, you know, we take turns describing who had this greatest accomplishment or this greatest sort of boast or something that you did in the past, right? And one of the framings that we did was, my knights in my game are older, right, at this point in the campaign. Let's say this is like the tournament period, right? These are the characters who are with them since the boy came. They fought through Badon Hill. They've done everything with him, right? They went to the continent. They went to Italy, got Holy Roman Emperor, you know, like they did the whole shebang. And they're now talking with the next generation of kids who did not have that experience. You know, they're all about the tournaments. They're all about like that Instagram life of like having the coolest, like the best hair, the best fashion, you know, all the pageantry of jousts and things like that. And so when they're, so you can describe how, you know, a low role in that situation is incredibly, it's not just like, you know, I was there at Badon Hill, you know, and like, you know, we were forced to eat our, you know, like the mules and stuff on the fourth night, we were exhausted and, you know, my sword broke twice, you know, or whatever. And like, everyone's like, yeah, whatever, dude. Like, anyways, we're talking about this tournament, right? And like, so you can imagine sort of this sort of disparity of like, what real war is and the PTSD of that and the severity and like how that made them who they are compared to this new generation, or just so much younger and so much like more, not necessarily narcissistic, but like, you know, just it's a different world. It's just a completely different world under Pax with Oriana, right? And so that sort of dichotomy, just from a simple card of like, go around and explain your boasts, right? So all of a sudden it has all this extra meaning and overlay baked into just this card because of all the context from the game. And I think that's so, it's incredible. It's incredible to see how everything comes together.
So you've been running the game long enough that you've seen multiple generations of these dynastic families as well.
Yeah, we're not grandchildren.
Did you have anyone actually make it to some form of retirement, or have they all fallen on the field or anything like that?
No, we've had plenty. We have characters retire. Collins chose to end his characters at later dates, which is totally cool. Spoilers, I guess. But like, I think like he wanted, or they wanted something to be like ignoble, like the idea of that, like they were just drunk one time and just like tripped, and like this sort of inglamorous thing. Is like, I don't know, just Collins an interesting character, and you know, and Colin just wanted it. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. Like, and but other people, you know, Collins' character, Acewind, retired and basically went to a monastery and was like praying and helping people during the start of the like the wasteland spreading and helping fix people there, because they have a very high piety, like a high religious. So they're like, yeah, let's be spiritual and let's do this, right? And like that sounds like a perfect kind of ending, right? And I think Jim's character Gorthrin, they retired, and they actually like they were retiring at the same time as the Earl was retiring at this point. And so they just both of them, and I was like, no, it'd be fun. Like, what if they just both went on a pilgrimage, you know? And so like for a little bit, they were just out of the picture entirely, because they, them and the Earl. And it was this really interesting point, because when characters are this old, right, you know, in like their 40s and 50s, and they're all decrepit, and they're falling apart, and they're technically still of the service, you have this, but then you also have the hungry kids below them who are like, let me have my shot. You're not letting me have my shot. You know, at this point I have kids of my own, you know, and I'm still not, you know, patriarch. And so like, you can actually play that up a little bit and have this sort of like dichotomy. And I think a little bit more of on that would be interesting to bring into the next game. So much of your next character is kind of like, it's at a risk of becoming too samey as your original character, but actually like having this sort of tension of not, you know, always being under the shadow of your father and not being able to play and like develop at, like, I don't know, that's just some kind of like character growth, like passively being like, okay, the longer I don't change my character, the more like resentful they are to him, or like the more like, you know, they're different. And it's one of those like weird foibles things about the generation stuff. But yeah, that, I think that's definitely something that I'm gonna look more into as well, is just the idea of your children not necessarily becoming the same as your parents, right? Your parents should definitely have an impact on your kids and your behavior and stuff like that, but like you're kind of your own person, But I think part of a concession of Pendragon is that like you're playing your next character and they will just be as like good, almost like in a Lamarckian evolutionary way, where like you just inherit the traits of your father, right? Rather than you know, so I don't know. I think there's something interesting there, because it'd be really cool to play like the black sheep, like I'm not like my father at all, and play with that sort of juxtaposition, right? And have that being like, well, you know, my father was super honest. I'm super suspicious because I think he was a fool, you know, and like, and have that sort of like ability be rewarded. Now that's kind of play, rather than necessarily becoming like, well, I'm, you know, I'm honest like my father, be default.
You've also done some cool stuff with inclusivity in your character creation and dynasties and things like that. You've modernized the game in many ways. How are you approaching, you know, LGBTQ characters and concepts like we need to have heirs for the dynasty to continue, we have political marriages, these sorts of things? You know, how did you bring that into the modern era?
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so actually, I did it two ways. The first way is that I kind of divested the gender from the structural roles in society. So the structural roles in society are the important ones. You have the soldiers, and then you have the people who support the soldiers, right? You have the entire logistical branch of, you know, your spouses and your stewards, right? And so I ended up, my two genders ended up being these roles in society. One is your knights, and one is your stewards. And I kind of just based everything off that. As far as like the actual marriages and things like that goes, I'm totally fine with like the gay marriage stuff like that. You can just have surrogates and things like that. As far as I'm concerned, I don't really about that kind of logistics. But I think the interesting thing though that I decided to keep as the tension was monogamy. Monogamy though is still super important because that is inheritance, right? So the idea is that how do I open up the world to be more inclusive and accepting, rather than just, you know, as much as one of my players wants it to be like as traditional and as hardcore as it could be, I was like, no, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to be homophobic and things like that on a streamed game. I don't think that's a good, you know, like I don't want to do that. So anyways, so like how do I balance the tension and keep this tension rather than just letting anything go while also providing space for characters to be different and expressive and things like that? And I was like, oh, well, just maintain monogamy. And the tension of monogamy being like as just as heartbreaking and melodramatic as any other stories, right? Just removing the gender, but keeping the power imbalances.
Medieval society, it all comes down to power. So, No, I think that similarly you did it in a very elegant way. If anyone watches the stream, it plays out perfectly. So,
yeah, thank you.
Coming back to transitioning out of Feaster in our annual feast phase. And this is so important because in Arthur's court, Pentecost is his big holiday. So the game kind of structures around that. That's when he brings all his knights in. And then he sends them out on quests. Or they're going to have, you know, these 44 days of duty that they are owed to their liege every year. That brings us to summer. The GPC has multiple phases, right? Like there are going to be strings of years where you are just doing battle after battle. Conquest, things like
Conquest.
That.
Conquest. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Did that get old?
Definitely. It definitely gets old. But where I most felt it was not the battles of the conquest. It's actually the tournament period for me that where it really felt like I was like, okay, how many more jousts are we going to go through? There's not a lot of stakes other than who wins. So like I wish for a little bit more out of the tournament stuff when I was doing it. Yes. So it would get old that way. But I think there's also ways of keeping things refreshing and interesting, even among that context. And the truth is because you just have to defocus the tournament part of the tournaments. And so what you do instead is find out, you know, you're not really playing necessarily to see who wins and how well you do in the tournament. It's like how you behave yourself during like the, you know, the all of the, what do you call it, pageantry parts, right? And especially when you're like, oh man, and this is hosted in a place where I'm not really well liked here, right? Or like this is like my rival's place and I'm supposed to conduct myself in a good way. And so then it gets interesting that way because all of a sudden you're like, well, you're in an unfamiliar situation or you're in a situation that, you know, can really tempt, like taunt you or tempt you or and stuff like that. And can you keep your cool? And then that becomes interesting to me to see how you handle yourself in that sort of strict situation, not necessarily your performance on the scoreboard at the end of the day, but like really how you handle yourself emotionally, internally, in the battle within, kind
of. Of course, there are some significantly big quests, the Grail quest, things like that, that will come into play. Yeah. It seems to me, and you know, I have not run it like you have. It seems to me like there's actually a lot of opportunity for players to go off and do their own thing.
Oh yeah.
You can bring in as much of the fairy tale influence as you want.
Absolutely.
From what I've seen, you've run a pretty quote unquote historical game with not a ton of that. Do you think you would change that in the future?
Yeah, I think I would. So right now, I let the tournament period and things and fairy and the other stuff come more into play at this time. So that's a big thing. In fact, like sort of a deal with the fairy is kind of one of these big concerns right now. And so I think going, if I look back at it, I probably would do more with the mythical than I did just the strict historical context I've been doing earlier, but also keeping things rather historically kind of quote unquote strict, but then letting space to be things to be ambiguous, miracles to be like, oh, was that just a lucky turn of events? Was that planned? That sort of ambiguity is actually like really, really, really fun to play with. In a lot of ways, it's fun to not necessarily go too hard in one way, but leave an option, leave outs for more of the magic and the mystery and religion to play a role.
It also makes it feel more impactful when it's overt, right?
Right. So if what I would say is if a character has a high fairy lore, then they should probably see more fairy stuff than others. I describe it sort of like it's like your lens. It's almost like your spiritual, like if you're super religious, you see things in a religious way because that's what you are. You can't help but like, embody that kind of perspective, right? And so, just in the same way, like if you were Mordred and you see your world is viewed as betrayal and stuff, you're going to be a cynical person. You're going to see the worst in people. Like just because that's how, you are what you see and what you experience and backwards, right? And that sort of feedback loop of that kind of lens, letting things, so if you're very religious and very spiritual, then you should see the spirituality and see the lens of that and other people. And actually, just to build on that real quick, consequently, this is something I took from Paladin, but I don't exactly recall the name of it, but there's something about when you describe characters, it's like, this is the trait that they look at and judge other people from. And so this was like one of the best pieces of advice I got from that reading it over. And that's like when you play a character, like think of their lens of what they look like. So for example, think about like what your Earl could be like. So if your Earl was their highest status Valor, then they judge their knights on Valor, right? They look at everybody and be like, who's my valorous guy? Obviously there's stuff about familial connections, like economic, and there's plenty of other ways to play with it. But like in general, when they meet somebody, like for example, when knights are being introduced, or if you go to a new court and you're introducing yourselves to the Earl or the Baron or whoever is the owner of this court, right? They're not going to necessarily talk to the oldest knight or even necessarily the one with the most glory. They're going to look at the person who has the most valor and be like, oh, you must be the leader of the group. Hello. Like you're clearly the leader, right? And like they judge people based on those sort of approaches and that kind of lens, because that's how they see the world. And you can kind of get an idea of how you see the world through your character traits, right? So that kind of feeds back on each other.
Sage advice. So we move out of the adventuring phase. It's the harvest. You're back at your estate. Yeah. Maybe we're bringing in justice events. You have some great generators that you've both found and created that you can kind of see on your stream when you're rolling those. I find the justice events to be super fun. Short, set it up for the listener. How do you run those?
Totally. Okay. So through the different eras, I invoke different economic things, right? And, but one of the things that's sort of held true across all eras is my justice events. And justice events, I believe, come from Book of the Manor, right? Because they are a modifier that you would roll just to determine whether or not, it's a modifier to a modifier to a roll about whether or not you make your harvest this year and how much money you get, right? But like when your characters have enough money, all of a sudden, like this sort of like little percentages of stuff doesn't really matter as much, but you're still kind of in this finicky zone. But we love the stories and stuff, these justice events. So like I just created a generator and from the ideas of like, okay, who's convincing who and what's the issue about? It just does a fun little flavor thing. And because despite the idea of, you're a round table knight, you just came back from, a daring raid in France, right? They've stopped a war. You still come home and you still got to deal with like a peddler who's like, complaining about a friend in the town over the ownership of a pig and that they cheated him out on some money. And like, so like, it's just so much fun to just bring things back to like this sort of like funny, quirky thing. And like, that's sort of like our favorite spot to inject a lot of humor into the game, because our game can be somewhat serious. We don't necessarily always want to be serious. And I think it's really fun to have that sort of aside and have our little justice events remind us that, like, you know, while we're having these giant, epic, melodramatic struggles of this internal strife and external politics and the shaping of the realm, you know, we're also dealing with these peddlers and the lower peasantries and their problems about, you know, like someone insulted someone about their fashion, you know, and like they had a brawl and now you have to, you know, punish them. So I think it's just really fun to always bring things back down that way.
It's also a good opportunity to bring the Knight's Manor into play, because if you're always off questing, you're not seeing it, right? If you're always at a feast, it's not at your hall, right? Are there other tricks? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I cut you off. I got so excited, but I think you were actually about to ask the exact question. It's like, what are some tricks to bring the manor into play? And I think it goes back to that sort of seamless that I have. And one of my favorites is I have a question of your relationship with your land. And I have that as sort of like your relationship with your manor. But like, you know, it's just a simple question you can ask. It doesn't even have to necessarily be for a role or a thing like that. It's like, just ask a knight, like, where do you go on your manor for peace and quiet? When you look out the vista from the top of your manor, right, and you look out, what's your favorite thing that you see? What is
so fun.
You know, like, yeah, right? Like, and you can also, you can combine that with other like questions and like the prompts, you know, like a relationship with your children and be like, you know, what part of your manor do you take your kid, but when you have that talk about, you know, like, listen, you're going to be a knight and you're going to inherit this someday, you know, Simba, I'm going to need you to, you know, rule this kingdom and all this land, you know, and like, where does that take place? And it's like, is it at your favorite place? Is it like, you know, is it at the stables when you're like grooming like your favorite war horse? You know, like I think contextualizing where this happens and you're kind of like the spot where you're, this is the character's favorite place in the land, like that matters. And so remembering that, because then about their favorite locations, because then you can inject stuff where it's like, oh man, Mordred burned your stables down and that was your favorite stable, you know, like they hit you where you love, you know, like a Superman, like, you know, you don't want to target Superman by going after Superman, you go after what he loves. And so the same thing in the game here, where it's like, oh well, if you really want to be dramatic, you can inject something tense and drama in the situation where this is the person where they found strength, and now it's a question of like, you know, it casts a pale light on it, and it's really fun.
The thing with the manor is you start to have a sprawling cast of characters. If you look at Book of the Entourage,
oh my god,
you can have so many characters come into play. You know, how one, you're playing with two players, which gives you a lot of space to work with those little vignettes and still have the spotlight shared around.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think the game scales to a large party?
You need an hour per player. That's what I think. To really get into those vignettes, you need an hour per player. But I think if everyone was on the same page, you could get by with half an hour per player.
Okay.
But that would require like a really good flow chart, and you're kind of, everyone kind of is on point and firing on cylinders and not too many distractions, which I can't help but get distracted sometimes.
No, I mean, there's all these little moments create such fun at the table.
What do you think?
I think I could get away with running for three. I think I would want to do probably two, because it creates just like this such an intimate game where everyone has time to shine. You can really get into different aspects of it. You know, get the players a real feel for their characters, as opposed to, okay, your 20 minutes is up for the day, you know?
Exactly. It feels so much more personal. And the only thing I also add is that because you'll be talking about this game and you're running in and you're obsessed with it, your friends will ask you, like, what's this Pendragon game you keep talking about? And they're like, well, how about you come on and play sometime? You just be an NPC. And it's totally cool to throw in an extra person that you can be there during Feaster in the summer and stuff. And then they leave and it's fine. And it doesn't really inject too much or like take away from other people's spotlights or anything like that. Well, they also get a chance to play this game and kind of experience it as these, you know, rotational characters. Like, they can easily come in as a round table knight or just pick up and role play as one of these, you know, your Earl at one time or, you know, whoever. You know, or one of the million people from your entourage would be super fun to play, right? Or even your spouse. So like, there's plenty of ways for people to get like an extra person to just stop in when there's only like two or a small table. It's much harder to give anything like that to anybody if you're running with four people or more, I'm sure.
How do you balance handling so many NPCs and making them feel unique? Has it become a challenge when you have all these roundtable knights and manor personnel?
Yeah. It's literally, it's an impossible task to make sure every single person's unique and interesting at any given time. So a lot of it is just, I kind of just automate stuff. I have a spreadsheet with about 300 NPCs at this point listed that's just slowly age up with a little bit of descriptions. You know, if I have a generator for mannerisms and things like that of a knight or whatever. So if I need that, I do that. And if I really need to like roleplay a character and I have no idea where to start from, what I actually will do, and this is what I did in my game before, is that I will just go back and look at the last 3 years as prep, and I'll just kind of run solo events for them. And just kind of get an idea of like, what did they run into these last 3 years? What are they dealing with? Right. Oh, well, it turns out he's having an affair with somebody. Right. And like, he's dealing with that stuff as this is going on. So he's in love with someone else right now. And so like, okay, great. So I can role play this guy that he's really stressed out and all these things or blah, you know, and all of a sudden I get this idea just from these random tables of just like, okay, well, what was the last 3 years or so? And I, because once you get a little bit of that, you can understand someone's trajectory right now. So you don't really have to remember what they were doing 10 years ago. You just can roll even like 1 year ago to be like, what's on their mind from last year that they're struggling with, right? That a problem that hasn't been fixed yet. And so from there, you can just inflate that and use that as help as a lens for describing the character for when you need them.
Continuing our talk of these random events, winter phase.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone calls it doing taxes. I think it's so much more than that. You know, we are abstracting a huge portion of a year in that. It's also where players have a lot of agency over the manor and things like that. Looking at the 6th edition starter set, it's pretty trimmed down. The 5.2 version is fairly long, and you can get a larger sheet of it and work more things into it. Tell me a little bit about your approach, because you've had some amazing moments come out of it as well. It's not just, we're going to buy an apiary. You know, it's...
Exactly. Gary, I know. I wish we had even more time to just describe all the random stuff that's happened during these events. But like so many times in the winter, especially during survival roles that have just completely just right turned the entire campaign where, you know, because I'm not sure I would recommend it after what I've done so far. It's really dangerous to do this, but like roll survival checks for every named NPC, right? Following the rules in the game and see what happens. Right. So like if you do that, like, yeah, like I've had my earls pass away, multiple earls pass away, and that left a huge power vacuum during the anarchy. Right. So there's all of these major issues that are happening. You know, we've lost spouses before during these times and how this has changed characters' trajectories. So definitely stuff like that is like you shouldn't sleep on for sure. But I think I would speak mostly about the winter phase. Is the winter phase should actually change with the eras that you're running. Like, for example, I think in like the Uther period and Anarchy period, I think it's very important that you really emphasize the cattle raiding part in the fall. Like, this is the thing that separates you from being poor and being normal, is robbing from your neighbor. It is a zero-sum world that you live in, right? But then by the time you get to Pass the Boy King and the Conquest and Pax Arthuriana's out there, like, you know, all of a sudden it's like, yeah, you're not raiding anymore. You have friends, you have your own trade network set up, you know, you have all these things set in and like just the standard of living is raised. So like maybe not, you're not necessarily counting every penny, right? But you still want some of this texture of the winter without necessarily counting every single Libra, right? And so like figuring out how to like shift between these zones. And then when you get to the tournament period, guess what? Money's really important again, because you're betting, you're putting all of your have the best gear, the best fashion. You need all that kind of stuff to present yourself best in the pageantry. So all of a sudden, like it switches gears again and goes back to being really important. So like finding a one size fits all solution is, I don't think, is actually the right answer. I think it's actually figuring out what to put on the, you know, what, you know, if this is a train going somewhere, like what, you know, what extra bits are, you know, what carts are going on here? What's going off the last junction for the next era? You know, and kind of keeping it modular.
On the occasions that I am able to catch the stream or a video, I always look forward to that section, because
spreadsheets,
the death of characters is so impactful. Even like, you know, I don't want to spoil anything if anyone's going to go back and watch, but you know, those hard right turns create amazing character moments. And you know, there's a resonance throughout every year after
Yeah.
Which is, well, you don't get that in another game unless you work super hard at it.
Yeah. Well, Carrie, if I'm completely honest with you, I didn't really understand this until this happened to me in my life, very personally. I was kind of blessed until very recently where like I really experienced some serious grief in my life. I had that hit me in a way that it just, you know, I've had other people lost my life before, but I don't know, this one just hit me differently and it definitely changed my life in a way. And it's like, I could totally see how that affects a character. And the idea of using, again, grief as a lens of seeing the world and how it affects people and the space that is no longer there for them, that, yeah, and seeing the impact of that loss through NPCs as well, who also knew them, is like, I think that's where the world feels very real in this game. And like from the space that this person took up that is no longer here, it's very, very, very cool. At least it's, to me, it's very interesting to bring that sort of reality into the game.
Well, I'm sorry to hear you've been going through that. Looking at the mechanics of the game as well, there are mechanics for like melancholia, losing control of characters, you know, when they're overwhelmed with grief because they failed a passion role and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
The mechanics and the thematics are just so well intertwined. It's
oh, yeah.
There's a reason they call it Greg Stafford's magnum opus, right? Like,
yeah.
RuneQuest is great, but Pendragon.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I would say to new GMs, definitely don't shy away from it. Like when it doesn't feel like it fits, it's let it work out. You know, like the passion. Like I still remember one of those great ones was like we were on a raid in France, and you know, one of Colin's character failed a passion role, and just like basically just like, you know, we're getting ready to storm this thing, and we're kind of, you know, through this battle, and he just kind of just walks away. He's like, I'm not doing this anymore, and like there was like this, such like a huge poignant moment just from the dice. And I was like, yeah, we're in. Like, it's so good.
How did you handle
definitely
that with keeping him in the game?
We either let him play you know, one of the vassal knights of him or his squire, or like or we just you know, a supporting character in the other character's arc, right? For example, like if we're charging I forget the name of the like a fort or a town in France or whatever, right? Great. Well, you know, it's not just if we're all roundtable knights or whatever, like great, then they just play like Sagramore, who led the charge, and you're just gonna be Sir Sagramore for the rest of the scene, right? Which is cool. Congratulations, you get to be Sagramore. How cool is that, right? Like, or you know, Lamorak, or you know, anybody extra who would be like, you know, named, or the Earl if he's there, right? Mm-hmm. So like, there's plenty of people just to adopt. And just, you know, just you don't even have to have like the stats prepared for them. You could just be like, you know, they have a stat of this number. Like, I think they have a stat of like 17. You know, like they're this, and just go. So
yeah, just be flexible. I think
yeah, exactly.
I think that's the number one rule of GMing in general.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
Let's bring this home. 6th edition. Are you gonna make the jump?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I've already adapted the stuff from the starter set. I really, really like the changes to the passion rules. That's really converted me. But yeah, I'm 100% coming
for,
in.
For folks that may not know and maybe no 5th edition. What's the key change there for you?
Sure. So the key change is what happens when you fail passions that are relatively low. Because something that happens in 5.2 is that you don't really want to grow younger passions and lower passions, because the risk of failing them means like really you could lose your character to fits and things. You don't really want to risk that from as a player's perspective. You always want to kind of play to your strengths and stuff like that. But in 6th edition, while your benefit from a lower passion maybe isn't as high or great, the risk of losing because the passion isn't so high is equally not so severe. So you actually can feel comfortable kind of calling on some of these passions. In addition, I also love the idea of the passions. You have a limited space for passions. I forget what they're called, the suits or...
Yeah, I
forgot the name of them, but like they group passions into... They group, yeah, you group passions into categories, and of those categories, there can only be like certain dominant ones, and that they become kind of zero sum in those realms or those suits. So like, I really like that idea too. Where that makes a lot of sense.
So, yeah, like that also you can only be loyal to so many people.
Yeah, exactly, right. So I think that's kind of stuff is super, super keen to be included. I'm excited to see what else gets added.
So we will get the player's handbook order next month, along with the Grey Knight. Did you run the original Grey Knight at all?
Yeah. Yeah, I did run the original Grey Knight. It's incredible. Yeah.
Yeah, Larry DeTilio.
So we got the... Yeah. So we did... is that from Saxon Shore originally?
I know it was
or not,
its own
not
book.
Saxon Shore, but one of them. Yeah. I grabbed the old one. And that was, yeah, it was super fun. It definitely didn't go the way I expected it to go, but it's just like one of those great Arthurian stories that like, oh yeah, we actually get to play it out. It feels great.
So any parting thoughts? Yeah. We missed that you do want to get in?
Yeah, for sure. So we didn't really talk about where I got started in Pendragon, of like how well in the source material I got into it. And I would say as a new GM, I would say that really the only thing I would say that's probably mandatory is watch the 1981 film Excalibur. I think that is really the only thing you really need to do. I think even prior to that, I think I also read Once in Future King, and I probably saw like, you know, a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, or like something, you know, some like, you know, some kind of movie like that. So like,
Knight's
I was a
Tale.
little bit familiar. Yeah. Like a night. Oh yeah. Knight's Tale for sure. That's also a must watch. Right. So a Knight's Tale and Excalibur are probably the two number one movies to get to know. You don't have to read anything. Right? Since then, you know, you have the Green Knight and this other stuff as well.
Do you run in tandem with Lamort d'Arthur? Cause there are in the current version of the GPC, there are notes like, oh, this corresponds with this chapter entry. Yeah.
No, honestly, I tried to read Lamore and I could not, didn't like it. Sorry.
Yeah, it's a tough read. Nothing, like... yeah,
it is. It is. My joke is that the amount of smiting that happens on those pages is maybe a little bit too much for me. But I will say the book that I wish I read going into Pendragon, especially if I wanted to hit more of a historical take, would be Bernard Cornwell's Warlord Trilogy. That definitely, if you want our good homework assignment before you run the game, read that series. That's pretty good. It definitely helps though, if you watch Excalibur and like have a little bit familiar with the source material beforehand, to see how things get kind of reimagined. But like, so that's why I wouldn't recommend it as the first source. But if you want to see an interpretation of like where your game could go and stuff like that, I think that's a very interesting one to take.
I think this has been a super fun discussion. We covered a lot of ground. Where can folks find you on the web?
Sure. So I'm mostly at YouTube these days, at youtube.com/Eric Vulgaris. So you can catch me running Pendragon pretty much every Sunday, assuming scheduling. But yeah, that's
you can. And you have another endeavor that you're running currently as well.
Art and Vol. The Halls of Art and Vol is like my other big major game right now, using Shadow Dark.
That's a big dungeon crawl. And how many years left do we have in the GPC if folks are looking to get caught up?
Sure. I mean, I think I'm at episode 150 something right now. 100, I think somewhere around that point. So about 15 years left. Episode 130. We just finished year 551. Yeah.
There's a light at the end of that years. Tunnel.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really weird to think that we only have like 15, 16 years left of the game. But it's definitely everything, we've hit the apogee of Arthur, and we're in the downfall. We're starting that descent right now, and it's super fun. Setting that stuff up has been a dream. I think I really nailed how I could handle the villains and like sort of why the Grail is important right now, you know, and Mordred and all that kind of stuff. And I think I'm really happy with how it came out.
Awesome. Well, congrats. It's just so cool to see like that arc and that evolution, because it really does kind of tie it up in a nice, neat little bow by the end.
Oh yeah, and for sure. And you know, the closing remark is like, all my other two players, like we're also relatively familiar with King Arthur stuff, right? Like we know Mordred, and we knew that there's going to be the, you know, the battle and how this stuff is going to go. So it's really fun right now to be like, it's okay. You know, there's no more threats on the horizon. Pax Authoriana is here to stay. You know, like they'll just deal with this wasteland and everything's going to be okay. Right. We, you know, Mordred, you know, we'll have an heir. It'll be fine. And then everything will be peace in our time. And so it's super fun to talk about this way, knowing the dramatic irony of everything that's going to come unfolding and crashing down the next 15 years.
All right. Well, let's wrap it here. Thanks for joining me. It's been fun.